Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Mem Tet Amud Aleph by the Gemara. Just to review quickly, we finished off with the Mishnah yesterday. The Mishnah is comprised of three parts. The first part of the Mishnah discusses the fact that when an Adam causes a woman to miscarry, then he is responsible for the Dmei Vladot. On the other hand, when an animal causes the miscarriage, is not responsible for the Dmei Vladot. And that has to do with the fact that, first of all, the Psukim specify that it's an Adam and not a Sure, as well as the fact that we learned in the Gemara earlier on, the possibility that Ubala Shornaki comes to be Poter Mimdmei Vladot. The second part of the Mishnah discusses how to value the Dmei Vladot, and there we had a machloka between the Tanakama and Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, which we will discuss further today. And then the last piece of the Mishnah talks about the rights to the Dmei Vladot, that those rights belong to the Bal Haisha, to the one who is the father of the Vladot that are found inside the woman. He is the one that is entitled to it. What happens if that individual either has no inheritors or he doesn't exist? Then who is the primary recipient of that money? That's what the last part of the Mishnah discussed. And again, the Gemara is going to go through each of these sections and discuss it in further detail today. So the Gemara says in the first piece, Taima demitkaven lechaveiro. That's only because he intended to hit his friend. I mean, this animal was going after one of his friends. And instead, he ends up hitting the Isha. Hamitkaven l'Isha. On the other hand, if he intended for the woman herself, Mishalem Dmei Vladot, he would pay Dmei Vladot. That would be problematic for the position of Rav Adar Ba'ava, which we're going to see later on in the Gemara. Shvarim, when they intend to injure the woman, when they are intending to do damage to her and it causes a miscarriage, they are not responsible. They do not have to pay for Dmei Vladot. So Rav Adar Ba'ava sees no difference between whether the shor intended for his friend and then accidentally hurts the woman, or whether they are directed at the woman herself, and that causes the damage and the miscarriage here. So our Mishnah seems to indicate otherwise. Some of the Rav Adar Ba'ava, hu adin, dafilin itkavnu l'isha, even if they intended for the woman, nami p'turim ibdnei v'ladot. Even in that scenario, they're p'turim ibdnei v'ladot. So then why in the Mishnah does it specifically give a case in which the animal is chasing down his friend and then happens to hit the woman afterwards? V'haktani shor she'am itkaven l'chaveiro. Why is that language used then? It should just simply say, sure, that goes out and damages the woman. That would have been sufficient. So I need to call by the mitna seifa adam she'am itkaven l'chaveiro, because in the other part of the Mishnah, I mean, the contrasting scenario where it's dealing with an Adam, over there it's specifically where he intended to damage his friend. His friend steps out of the way, and then he ends up injuring the woman or causing her to miscarry. Because that's how the Psukim lay out the case over here. So therefore, also in the Reisha, when it's discussing this case of the Shor, it gives you, again, a parallel structure to the case of the Anashim. Because the case of the Anashim in the Torah, so there is a case when they're fighting, and then they end up hitting or damaging the woman. So in that case, you see that the case in the Torah and the case in the Mishnah that deals with Adam is a case where he intends for one and ends up hitting the other. So all the Mishnah did was create a parallel structure by Behemah to say the case by the Behemah is that it intended to hurt its friend, and in the end, it just hit the woman. But in Ochanami, if it went directly after the woman, it'd still be patur mi-dmei v'ladot, because that is the gzera ta-katuv with regards to dmei v'ladot. Now the Gemara continues. Amar Papa, shor shenagach et ha-shifcha v'yatzu yiladeha. A shor that damages, gores a shifcha knanit, and that causes her to miscarry, mishalem dmei v'ladot. In that instance, you do pay dmei v'ladot. So as opposed to a free woman, that if the animal we saw with Rav Adar Ba'ava, even if he directly attacks the woman and that causes her to miscarry, there the owner of the animal is patur from the Dmei Vladot because of Gzerat HaKatuv. Over here, Rav Papa opens up the possibility that that's not always the case. That there are cases where a woman can miscarry because of an animal's attack, and despite that fact, you will be chayav for Dmei Vladot. My time, what's the reasoning behind Rav Papa's position? What is the logic? You just damaged a pregnant donkey. Damakra, the pasuk says by Avram Avinu when he's going up to the Akidah, he says to his shnei ne'arim, shvulachem poi machamor. You guys hang out with the donkey, and then Yitzhak and I will go up and return. Am hadomela chamor. Chazal dashin from that, that it's a nation. The Knanim are a nation that is domela chamor, or in essence, we don't view them as being quote-unquote humans in this case. Rather, we view them as being possessions or the monetary rights of the owner. And so for that reason, it's no different than causing an animal to miscarry versus causing a human being to miscarry. When you have an animal that miscarries, that's all part of the nezek that one does to an animal, and you're responsible for that. On the other hand, by the woman, there's a special situation with regards to the mei v'ladot, both because of who it belongs to, not to the woman who's carrying it, but rather to the baal, but also because of the fact that the miscarriage, the din is bifurcated between if it's an adam that caused it, where you will be chayav, or it's an animal that caused it, that you will be patur. Now, it's clear that when it comes to an eved k'nani and a shifcha k'nanit, that they have this dual aspect to them, which is that, of course, they are human beings. Of course, they have to be treated with respect like a human being. But on the other hand, they are also property, and they are sold and bought, and the possessions of the individuals that own them. The real question here is, where on that continuum does the quote-unquote human side end, and the monetary or possession side begin? So over here, the Gemara says that with regards to Dmei Vladot, since the Dmei Vladot are owned by the Adon, by the master, and not by the woman herself, of course, but not even the person who engaged with this woman and got her pregnant, he's also not entitled to the Dmei Vladot. The Dmei Vladot belong to the owner of the Shifcha Kananit. For that reason, when there's a miscarriage over here, we don't view it as a classic miscarriage of Dmei Vladot. We simply view it as a loss of the possessions of the Adon. And since that's the case, it's equivalent of regular Nezek. And because of that, you're going to be Chayav for Dmei Vladot here, even though generally there's an exemption for Dmei Vladot or a miscarriage that is caused by an animal. Now, the Baalei HaTosafot take issue with this. They don't mention, but it's true we know by a Shor Mu'ad and a Shor Tam that if they kill an Eved or a Shifcha K'nanit, that they are subject to a death penalty. That's not only true of a Shor, but it's also true of a human being. Any person that kills an Eved K'nani or a Shifcha K'nanit is subject to a death penalty. So in terms of treating them like human beings, where we say in the halacha, it's very clear that they're treated in that manner. And what's interesting is that when it comes to a boar, we know that with regards to a boar, there are certain exceptions to the rule of a boar. Shor velo adam, chamor velo kelim. That means that if you have kelim that get damaged in the boar, you are patur. And adam that dies in a boar that isn't of sufficient depth, then you're also patur. So now when you say shor velo adam, that adam's not included, we also exclude with that shor velo adam the Eved K'nani and the Shifcha K'nanit, that if they were killed in the boar, they're no different than any other free person, and they are Ptorim. So that seems to contradict the view of the Gemara over here, our perspective on this Shifcha K'nanit and Eved K'nani. With regards to the Dmei Vladot, they are considered like Chamor. They're considered to be like property. And so therefore, the Dmei Vladot are just Nezek and not the classic Dmei Vladot. Yet in all these other circumstances, like by boar, by the case of Shor Mu'ad that kills, or by the case of Adam that kills, in all those cases, the Shifcha K'nanit and the Eved K'nani are treated like full-fledged free people, and the person that causes their death is liable for causing their death. So Tosafot wants to know, how do you reconcile between here and the case in Bor? Why don't you just say by the case of Bor also that it was Chamar Tabalma, they're just the donkey, and that's the case. Chamor Velo Kelim means that you're Chayav or Chamor. So why aren't you responsible for the monetary loss from this Eved K'nani or Shifcha K'nanit that died in the boar and have to at least make restitution to the owner of the slave? So why is it there we don't consider it that they are chamorim? And over here we do consider them to be chamorim. So Tosafot suggests that there is a difference in the case because he says, Yesh lamar d'hacha lo mieta katuv shor b'dmei v'ladot al makom shav ladot shel baal. That the structure of the pasuk is that where do you get the exemption from your animal causing a miscarriage? That's in a situation in which the whole story holds together, which is that there is a balaisha, that there is a husband over here, there is a father to the fetuses that are there. In that case, there's a din of dmei vladot. So then you would have to make compensation for the dmei vladot in the case where we can identify. It's obvious that there's a Bala Isha there, and therefore it fits into the story of the Psukim. On the other hand, if there's no Bala Isha, for example, in a case where you're dealing with a Shifcha K'nanit and the Adon, where there is no Bala Isha, In that case, they're not included in the parshia of Dmei Vledot. They're totally in a separate parsha of Nezek. And because of that, they are deemed to be Chamarta for Nezek, but not because underlying or fundamentally they are considered to be a Chamor. So the Baal HaTosafot, the default status, the default situation is that the Eved Kenani and Shifu HaKenanit are treated like regular human beings. If you want to say something otherwise, then that's a Chiddush, and that Chiddush has to be noted in the Psukim. And therefore over here, the Chiddush is that by the case of Baal HaIsha, when it's an animal, not a human being, that there is no compensation that is made in that case for the Dmei Vledot. The Rashba, on the other hand, answers the question by saying that by the case of boar, you have a separate problem. Ein Ochanami, that by boar, they should be treated like a chamor as well and be chayav. The only problem is that when an individual's possessions get injured in the boar, we say over there that vameit iyelo, that the deceased, or in the case of animals, the carcass that's inside the boar will belong to the nizak. But that means that he can get hana from it, that he can utilize it. Vameit iyelo. The problem by the case of an Eved Kenani or a Shifu HaKenani is that you can't say vameit iyelo, because, again, they are human beings. They do have a tzelem elukim. And for that reason, you can't get hana from the mate. And therefore, you can't accomplish or fulfill vameit iyelo. And so for the Rashba, the reason that boar is different is because of vameit iyelo, which you cannot carry out or does not hold true for the case of boar. So the Rashba, in his second answer, as opposed to Tosafot, who thinks the default status is that they're classified like regular human beings for all these dinim, with the exception of shor, because of the psukim that indicate otherwise. And then the Rashba seems to say just the opposite. The Rashba says that the default status is that they're treated like a chamor, unless I have information that indicates otherwise. And so that's the same story here, which is that we know that they should be considered a chamor. So if that's the case, by Dmei Vledot, you're chayav. By boar, you should also be chayav in that case. But there you have a special exemption from the pasuk of vameit iyelo. All right, now the Gemara continues to discuss the Mishnah. It says, Ketze Mishalim Dmei Vledot. The Mishnah discusses how exactly do you assess the value of these Vladot, this miscarriage that the person has to pay for. Gemara says, Dmei Vledot. Shevach Vladot mi baile. Why are you only speaking about the monetary value of the Vladot? What about the enhanced value that comes from the Vladot? So the difference between Dmei Vladot and Shevach Vladot is that Dmei Vladot are the value of the fetuses themselves, meaning that you could sell ownership or an option of ownership in these fetuses while they're still in utero, and then whoever buys them has the right, after they're born, to enslave them and make them into an Eved Kenani. On the other hand, there's also a part of value that is associated with the enhanced value of the woman for the fact that she's now carrying around these fetuses. And that enhanced value has to do with something that probably meant a lot more in their time, that the woman's heft and largesse are greater because of the pregnancy. And that is not only the weight gained from the pregnancy itself, the fetuses that are there, but there's additional weight that the woman puts on, an additional heft that the woman puts on, that is a shevach in a society in which that was prized, meaning that someone who was of a larger heft was considered to be healthier and considered to have more utility and be able to work harder and carry on life in a much more or productive manner. And so therefore, there's a shevach that's created here independent of the Dmei Vledot. And that's what the Gemara wants to understand. Why are you only assessing one of the changes in value, which is the Dmei Vledot? What about the Shevach Vledot? It says, Achinami Kamar. That's exactly what the Mishnah means. Ketze Mishalem Dmei Vledot V'Shevach Vledot. How do you pay, or how do you assess the value of the Dmei Vledot, the value of the fetuses, as well as the Shevach Vledot, the enhanced value to the woman? Shaminat Aisha Kami Yafa Achalo Yalda. That we assess the value of the woman prior to her giving birth. Kami Yafa Mishalda. And how much she's worth after she gives birth. So in that case, you have both values that are incorporated there. You have the value of the Dmei Vledot, which are still inside of her. And you also have the value of the Shevach from the pregnancy. So that is while she's still in the pregnancy or still carrying the pregnancy, then both of those items are going to be valued in the woman when she is sold, quote unquote, on the slave market, And that's the way that we would assess value of the individuals. But then after she gives birth, or in a case where she's caused to miscarry, then we value the woman without the vladot inside of her and without the shevach that's associated with the pregnancy. The difference in value would be the dmei vladot and shevach vladot. And that's what the Tanakam or the Chachamim say as to how you value the loss that is caused here by the miscarriage. So then, just as a side note, because it will come up in the Gemara further on, that the values that we are trying to determine over here are simply, number one, the dmei vladot, the value of the fetuses, and number two is the shevach vladot, which is the enhanced value of the woman. What we are not assessing over here is nezek of the isha, damage done to the woman. Because, as Rashi notes over here, there is no damage done to the woman. There is simply what's called pchat rikun, the diminishment in value from her being emptied, or meaning her releasing of the fetuses that are inside of her. That is all the diminishment in value. Aval, kachash kufa, if she actually was damaged, or through this she was weakened, machmata makah, because of the hit that she took or the blow that she took, then you would also have to pay for nezek. The nezek would be the difference in value between when the woman was healthy prior to the pregnancy and how she is now post the pregnancy, assuming she went back to her normal self and her former health, but now that's being inhibited by the fact that she was damaged or hit. That difference in value will tell you how much nezek, how much damage is done. That nezek, first of all, is not incorporated in the dmei vladot and the shevach vladot. It's a separate value that has to be calculated. And in addition to that, it has fixed ways to be paid. The Gemara Ketubot says the split of the nezek between the husband and the wife is set based on fixed parameters as to where the damage is done, whether it's something that's visible damage, where the husband then is granted more of the nezek payment, versus if it's damage in a place that is normally covered, where there the woman would get the majority of the value of the nezek. But that is a separate category and is not included in the Dmei Vladot and Shevach Vladot and is not even really of interest to us here because that's really something that is the value of the woman herself and belongs to her, the Nezek and Tsar that is caused to her. The reason that Rashi says that is he mentioned it before earlier in the Masechta that with regards to her miscarrying, that's no different than her giving birth to the fetuses. So the discomfort, the pain, and all that which is associated with birthing, whether she miscarries or carries the full term, both of those will take place. So there's no diminishment in value or nezek or tsar caused from the birthing process because the birthing process itself would have happened anyway, even if she carried to full term. And so we don't see that as being a nezek or a tsar because that was something that inevitably was going to happen anyway for this woman. Right, so now, Amar Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, Imke Misha Isha Yoladet Mishabachat. Your assumption, or the underlying premise of your valuation here, is that a woman's value goes up when she is pregnant, and then diminishes after the pregnancy has been completed, or been terminated. My kamar, what is he saying over here? Amar Abba, hachi kamar, v'chi isha mishabachat, kodem sheteled, yoter mishlachar sheteled? You're telling me that the woman is worth more when she is pregnant? Then post the pregnancy, the woman is worth more post-pregnancy than she is worth during the pregnancy itself. There are two reasons for that. Rashi over here brings the reason is because there's risk, especially where in a society is the mortality rates from giving birth were so high, there is significant risk in being pregnant. And so therefore, the woman post-pregnancy is safer and worth more because we know she survived the pregnancy. While she's pregnant, there's a huge risk to her life. Most of that has to do with infection as well as hemorrhaging at the time of birth. But because of the circumstances under which women gave birth, there was a high mortality rate. And therefore, you're at huge risk if you, quote unquote, were to buy a woman who's pregnant. You're better off buying her post-pregnancy. The second thing is that, as Yechiel noted, while the woman is pregnant, her utility diminishes significantly. She's not able to work anymore. She's not able to perform the services or the demands that are placed on her. After the pregnancy, she can return to her regular job, or after her maternity leave, she can go back to doing what she did before. So there you see, according to Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, that the value of the woman post-pregnancy exceeds the value of during the pregnancy itself. So now, how do you deal with that according to Rabbi Shimon Gamliel? El shamim et avladot v'notnim lebal. So what Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says is that you have to assess the demei vladot separately. If you simply take the value of the woman when she's pregnant and the value of the woman at post-pregnancy, you're not going to get the answer that you want. According to the Chachamim of the Tanakhama, that difference in value, which is how much the woman is worth more while she's pregnant, that difference in value will give you the assessed value of the vladot or the demei vladot. On the other hand, for Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, where the woman's value actually goes up post-pregnancy, then the difference between the pregnancy price or value and the post-pregnancy value is not going to give you any information with regards to what's the value of the demei vladot. And so, for that reason, he believes you have to independently assess the value of the fetuses. In other words, what you do is you say, how much would somebody be willing to pay for the option on these vladot? That he would have the right, if these fetuses were born healthy, and there is a successful pregnancy that's carried to term, how much would he pay for those fetuses? Obviously incorporating the risks that are involved at the time that he's purchasing the vladot. The risks that it won't make it, the risks that they won't be healthy. But given all that, what would he pay to that if they are healthy and they do go to full term, that he'd have the rights to them? And that's how you would assess the demei vladot over here. The shamim et vladot, notim laban. It goes to the husband because the husband is the one with the rights to the demei vladot. Tanya nami ochiv, a bright that it supports that understanding of shamim gamliel. Chi sham shabachat kodim shetileid yoter mishalacha shetileid. She's worth more prior to giving birth than she is after giving birth. The woman is more valuable, or her price goes up post-pregnancy than it does during the term of the pregnancy. Same tradition over here, that we try to independently assess the value of the vladot and give it to the baal. Now this is different than other cases that we've seen until now, where we demanded that, for instance, in a field where there was damage done, or in cases where there is a smaller portion of a larger item that was damaged, the parah that was pregnant. In all those scenarios, we said that you're shamin al-yadei, or al-gav, that you assess the damage to the field, al-gav, the entirety of the field. You assess the value of the parah and the baby together in order to assess then the value of the baby itself independently. So in all of those cases, you incorporate. Over here, that's not what Rav Shimon Gamliel suggests. He suggests that we have to separate out the two items, the demei vladot from the woman herself, or assessing it against the total value of the woman. And that might be because over here, the two entities are completely separate, meaning that they are not like a field, which integrally is really one big item, and you're just talking about a subsection of the field. Or if you're talking about the animal with its vlad, we see the vlad as an extension of the animal itself. But over here, by an isha and the demei vladot, over there we don't look at them as being a single entity. Because over here, the woman herself who's married is not owned by her husband, even though he owns the demei vladot. So in terms of shared ownership or a single entity, that's just not the case here, because the husband owns the rights to the demei vladot, but he doesn't own the rights to his wife. And so for that reason, you can't assess the value of the vladot, ayidei the isha, or that's why we would differentiate here in the way that we assess it versus other cases. Rava amar hachiktani. Rava on the other hand makes a different suggestion. V'chi isha demish yoledet mishabechet ve'en latzma v'shevach vladot klum. Your assumption here is that the woman that she gives birth for, meaning the individual who owns the demei vladot, the baal ha'isha, so you're saying to me that ve'en latzma v'shevach vladot, but she has no value over here in the shevach vladot klum. El shamim et vladot notim labal. You take the demei vladot, the value of the fetuses, and that's granted to the husband. B'shevach vladot, and then you separately assess the value of the shevach over here, which is the enhanced value of the woman, and chokim, and then you split it between the woman and the husband. So as opposed to the demei vladot, which completely belonged to the baal, over here, when it comes to the shevach of the isha, over there, they are joint owners in this, meaning that both the woman and the husband have rights to that shevach that is generated because of the pregnancy. Basically, because it's a zeb zeh goreim, which is that the bladot, or being pregnant, is what helps to enhance her value, aside from the fact that the enhanced value is herself, the change in her. And so therefore, the shevach bladot belongs partly to the woman, and partly to the husband. As opposed to the chachamim, who say the dmei bladot and the shevach bladot all belonging to the husband. Over here, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel is coming to argue and say, yes, the dmei bladot, because of the gzeret hakatu, belong to the husband, the bala isha. On the other hand, the shevach bladot, which is a value that is garnered both because of the fact that she has bladot inside of her, which is a contribution by the husband, as well as her own contribution, the fact that she is now larger, those two items together create the shevach bladot, and that should be split between the husband and the wife. Tanya Nami Ochi, we have a braita that supports that understanding. I'm Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, v'chi shada mit shiyoledet mishabechet. Is she only the shevach of the vladot only belong to the husband and not to her? V'ein latzma b'shevach vladot klum, and she has no rights to the shevach vladot. El shemin nezek b'fnei atzmo, v'tzar b'fnei atzmo. So here, this is what we discussed before. You have to assess each of these items independently. So you have to assess the nezek and the tzar independently, and those will belong to the woman herself. And then you have to assess the value of the fetuses themselves on a standalone basis. And that goes to the husband, because it says the bali isha. And the shevach of the bladot you split. So now, kasho, the Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, ad the Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. So now we have a stira within Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. Now here you had two opinions as how to explain Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, one from Rabo and one from Rova. But if that was the only thing that we had, then this whole thing would not be a question, because you have two Amoraim trying to explain the position of Shimon Gamliel, and they can disagree. The problem is that each one of them, we brought a Braita in their favor. And you have to now reconcile between the two different Braitot and try to understand how does Rabbi Shimon Gamliel have these two different and seemingly contradictory opinions. Where it says, Lokasha, kan mevakeret, kan shibaina mevakeret. Depends if this is her first pregnancy, or she's already post or past her first pregnancy, and now she's carrying in a second, third, or so on pregnancy. Difference being that bimavakeret, in the case where this is her first pregnancy, there is much greater risk to the woman of mortality in the case of birth when it is their first pregnancy, as well as there's a higher risk of problems with the fetuses, that there's a higher likelihood of loss or problems with them in the case where it's a first birth. And so for that reason, by the case of Mivakeret, then it's clear that the value of the woman while she's pregnant is not as high or is below the value of her post-pregnancy. Because once she's demonstrated that she's able to carry to full term, give birth, and then survive that, that's a huge plus for this woman now. She's now demonstrated her tremendous strength and abilities here by being able to survive a pregnancy and give birth to healthy children. So in that case, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says that the value of the woman clearly goes up at post-pregnancy. The case of She'ena Mevakeret, when it's not the first pregnancy, then that's the second bright of Rabbi Shimon Gamliel that says that there is Shevach Vladot. All of a sudden, Shevach Vladot, didn't Rabbi Shimon Ben Gamliel argue there is no such concept as Shevach Vladot? So the answer is there is shevach vladot, but that's not in the first pregnancy, that's only in subsequent pregnancies. There the woman does gain value, or shevach, in the term of the pregnancy that exceeds her value post-pregnancy, and you have to assign or assess that value of the shevach vladot. Alright, so now the Gemara continues. V'rabbanan, da'amrei shevach vladot nami lebao. The Rabbanan will believe not only are the Dmei Vladot belong to the husband, but so does the Shevach Vladot belong solely to the husband. My taimo, what's the reasoning behind their position? Kedetanan. We have a Mishnah, Kedetanya, we have an Ebraita. Imashma Shenemar, because it says in the Pasuk, V'yatsu Yiladeha, that she miscarries her children. Eni Odea Shehi Hara. Don't we know that she is pregnant in this case? So why does the Torah have to tell us the seemingly duplicate piece of information, which is v'chi anatzu anashim v'nakfu isha hara v'yatzu yiladeha? Of course, v'yatzu yiladeha, she had to be pregnant beforehand in order to have a miscarriage. She can't have a miscarriage unless she was pregnant. So why does it mention the word hara? Matam lomer hara lomalacha shevach harayon labal. all the value that comes out of the pregnancy belongs to the husband. So that's whether it's the direct value, which is the fetuses themselves, or it's even the indirect value that's created, which is the shevach of the isha that comes out of her gaining weight and heft from the pregnancy itself. That shevach harayon belongs to the baal, belongs to the husband as well. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, hai hara, my darish bay. What does Rabbi Shimon Gamliel do with the word hara? Mi bayile le katanya, he needs it for this braita. Rabbi Lezer ben Yaakov Amir, lo lamenu chayav, ad shi yakena keneged beit harayon. That the only way that you're going to be responsible for the miscarriage is if the blow to the woman was in an area that involved or was proximate to the uterus. Avarab Papa, lo tema keneged beit harayon mamash. Don't take it so literally that it means only if he hits her right where the uterus is, that's when he's responsible. If he hits her anywhere else, then he's not responsible. A kohecha de salik be shichma le vlad, anywhere where the heat reaches the vlad, la fuke yad regel delo, to exclude the extremities where that's not true. So, in the end, what Rav Papa suggests is that the blow does not have to be directly on the uterus, but anywhere within the body where the reverberations of that blow or the impact of that blow could affect the health of the fetus, the health of the vlad. So therefore, in a case where, there are two ways to read this, where the warmth, I would call it the warmth of the vlad reaches, which is that anywhere where the pregnancy is felt or you can sense the pregnancy or that the fetus will feel the blow, that's what you're chayav for. The other way to explain it is that the shichama means that the damage or the wound that was created from the blow, that if that heats up, it will affect the fetus that the woman is carrying. So either way that you explain it, what we're suggesting here is that it's any blow that would have impact on the fetus. That's whether the blow is causing an infection or some sort of problem that will reach the fetus. Or the other way around, that the heat of the fetus is felt, or meaning that the reverberations of anything that happens in the body is felt all around, and that basically has to do with the main trunk of the body to the exclusion of the extremities of the body. As long as they don't hit on the extremities, then you would be responsible for the damage that happens. Hayta shivcha v'nishtachara o gioret patur. So this goes to the next section of the Mishnah as to what happens in a situation where you don't have inheritors or the baal is missing. So if she was a shivcha and then she was freed, the assumption being here that she's married to an Evet that was also Mishuchrar, or a Gioret who was married to a Ger, and as Rashi noted in the Mishnah, Tosavot early on in the Masechta noted that it's Lav Dafka. It could even be a Ger that's married to Israelit, or in the case of an Evet Mishuchrar that's married to an Israelit. The reason that it just mentions these is because that's the normal scenario. That's number one. And number two is, as Rashi noted in the Mishnah, we are speaking about cases where there aren't any children here, which is indicated by the recent freeing of this shivcha. She's not a shivcha hamishuchreret, but rather a shivcha v'nishtachara, that she was just recently freed. As far as the shivcha knanit over here, while she's under the auspices of her adon, it's clear there that the dmei v'ladot do not belong to her, but rather they belong to the adon, the master, because that's the nature of the relationship, that she is property of the master, and therefore the dmei v'ladot belong to the master. If she was pregnant while she was a shivcha knanit, and then she is freed by the master, the question is, who owns the dmei v'ladot in that case? Do the dmei v'ladot then become hers? Because the ownership or the previous owner's hold here has been severed by the fact that she's now a freed woman, and that severs the monetary relationship between them. And the same way it severs the monetary relationship between them, it also severs the adon's right to the vladot, and therefore she becomes the quote-unquote owner or recipient of the dmei vladot. That is the sheet of the Rambam, that in the case where she is freed after she is pregnant under the auspices of the adon, that the dmei vladot belong to the woman. On the other hand, there are other mishonim, achronim, that believe in the case where she is freed after being enslaved and she's pregnant at the time that she is freed, that there the dmei v'ladot belong to no one. They don't belong to the adon because he severed the relationship. They don't belong to the shivcha because they never did belong to her. They belong to the Adon, and the Adon has, he's now been disowned from them because of the Shechrur, but nobody has exerted ownership over them, and we'll see a continuation of today's daf that maybe there's no way to acquire or to take possession of them while they're in utero. And for that reason, they're not owned by anyone. If there's a miscarriage over here, the person who caused the miscarriage would not have to pay anyone for the damage that is done in that case, where it's the Shivcha was freed while she was pregnant. Amar Rabba, lo shanu ela shechaval ba b'chaye ger, umeta ger. This is all true where the individual injured her during the lifetime of the ger, and then the ger dies. Because by the damage being done during the lifetime of the ger takes possession or has rights in those dmei v'ladot. The came into chaval ba b'chaye ger, since he did the damage or he hurt the woman during the lifetime of the ger, zocha b'hu ger. The ger takes possession or owns the dmei v'ladot. Became into meta ger, zocha b'hu min ager. And therefore, when the ger then passes away, then you're be zocheft in them from the ger, because the ger has no yorshim over here, and so all of his property becomes hefker. But that's only property that he had once owned, can he becomes hefker and people can take it. So over here, what the suggestion is that if the damage was done while the ger is alive, he already took possession or he owned those rights. And so when he passes away, those rights can be released because there's nobody to take them. And the one who is chayav to pay the dmei v'ladot is the first party to take them back. Aval chaval ba lachar mitat ager. On the other hand, if the damage was done after the death of the ger, zachila ihi bigavayhu. The woman is the one who owns the rights to the dmei v'ladot. Umichayev lishlumi la didida. And therefore, if someone caused a miscarriage in that situation, they would have to pay. Woman is carrying these fetuses for the miscarriage that happened because she became the quote-unquote, the owner of the Dmei V'ladot. Remember, until that point in time, they were owned by the ger himself. When the ger himself passes away, then you're left with the possessions of the ger, and first come, first serve. So over here, the Dmei V'ladot are part of the possessions or the ownership of the ger. So now when he passes away, that's part of the first come, first serve, which is that whatever you pick up, or you're the first one to pick up, you'll get to keep. And here, the woman is the earliest one to pick up, quote-unquote, the Dmei V'ladot, and therefore, she will be the one who gains entitlement to the Dmei V'ladot. So Amar Rav Chista comes along and argues on Rabba's position and says, Mari Daichi, the author of this position, Atu V'ladot Sorereinu, since when are V'ladot like money that you can B'zachir Bo, that you can acquire them and have Kinyanim on them, be koneh them, and you can activate Kinyanim through them. Ela ita labal zochale rachmana leita labal lo. That the Xerata Katuv is that when the husband is around, he is the entitled party. The Korah gave him the rights to it. On the other hand, leita labal, when there is no husband around, then lo. There is nobody who owns it. There is nobody who is entitled to the Dmei V'ladot. So he clearly argues on Rabba, there's no, quote-unquote, monetary ownership in the Dmei V'ladot. There's a Gzeret HaKatuv that the husband has rights to the Dmei V'ladot. But other than that, there's no real ownership in this woman. That's what Rashi says here. When there is no Balei Shah to collect on the Dmei V'ladot, the obligation only happens at the time of the injury. Barin Latovim. And there's nobody to make a claim on it. The Balei Shah, who's the one who's entitled, isn't around to make the claim. And since he's not around to make the claim, there's nobody to collect over here. If there's nobody to collect, there is no obligation to pay anyone. Rav Chista is saying that the Dmei V'ladot either belong to the husband or they belong to no one. Whereas Rabba says that they either belong to the husband or they belong to the wife. Which is that if the husband no longer has rights here because he passed away and he has no inheritors because he's a ger, then the woman takes over as the owner of the Dmei V'ladot. That's Rabba's position. Rav Chista's position is that when the husband's around, he owns the Dmei V'ladot. The husband's not around, no one owns the Dmei V'ladot. There is no ownership of the V'ladot until they are born, and then once they're born, then they own themselves at that point in time. The one thing to note, the Balei Tosafot say over here, that even Rav Chista, who says that if the husband passes away, the wife has no rights in the Dmei V'ladot, because he says, what, you're calling them money? You're calling them something that you can make a kinyan on? That's not true. But Tosafot says, despite that fact, the Yorshim lo polig Rav Chista. Rav Chista agrees when it comes to the inheritors of the husband, Modehu Dezachu, that he agrees that they are Zocheh, that they have rights to the Dmei Vladot over here. Unlike the woman herself that does not have the rights to the Dmei Vladot, the Yorshim do have rights to the Dmei Vladot, because Tosa brings a couple of proofs to the fact that when it comes to Yorshim, Yorshim are able to acquire not only the monetary possessions, but also the rights that the individual has. And over here, those rights to the Dmei Vladot is also passed from the father or the Baal down to the children or to those that inherit him. You can see there by the beginning of the Tosafot that there's a little Aleph from the Gra who says that most of the other Rishonim disagree with the Tosafot and think that Rav Chista is going to be consistent here. If he says that the Dmei Vladot cannot be acquired, they're not money, that means that the woman can't acquire them and the Yorshim can't acquire them either. Nobody can get them when the Baal passes away rights to the Dmei Vladot. Now, again, if the injury or the miscarriage happened before the death of the Baal, then in that case, they already went, or the value already accrued to the Baal, and therefore the other parties, the Yorshim or the woman, can collect on that. But where it's post the death of the husband, where now there is no Baal around, over there you can't say that the Dmei Vladot belongs to the husband, that he's now passing either to his wife or to his Yorshim. And so he's consistent in that, Rav Chista, that there is no money here, or the Dmei Vladot aren't able to be transferred. The ownership is not able to be transferred. Somebody injured a woman and it caused a miscarriage. The nezek and the tzar belong to the woman, which we've discussed many times, that that's hers. Again, the Dmei Vladot, the Torah says Baal Yisha belong to him. If the husband's not around, it goes to his inheritors. If the woman is not around, then it goes to her inheritors. If you remember, we saw this back in Gemara, Adaf Mem Bet, Amud Bet, and Mem Gimel Amud Aleph, and there the Gemara asked the question, what happened to the husband here? Why is the primary inheritors of the woman her Yorshim, and not the ultimate Yoresh of her, who is her husband? The Gemara there answered that it was a case of a Grusha, a case of a divorcee, where the relationship between the husband and wife had been severed. And since their relationship is severed, the woman's not going to give any of her possessions now to the ex-husband because he has no longer rights to inherit her. On the other hand, with regards to the Dmei Vladot, the Torah empowered or gave that right to the husband, and that's irrespective of the fact that they are divorced. If it's a case where this is somebody who is not going to have inheritors, then the person who owes the money is the first one to take possession of it, and he's zocheh, and he doesn't have to pay anymore. Amrei, umi adifa mimatnitan. What exactly is your question from here? You're bringing a question here on the position of Rabba, who says that the case of our Mishnah is limited or qualified by the fact that it happened b'chaye ager, and not after the death of the ger. And now you bring us a brayta, which seemingly doesn't differentiate between them, but neither did our Mishnah. If you look at our Mishnah, it never made those differentiations, yet we read it into the situation. You set up our Mishnah as being this unique case, according to Rabba, where the ger, the damage happened prior to the death of the ger. Again, the damage was done while the ger was still alive. Then only after the fact did the ger die, and that will be consistent with Rabba's position. Tosafot now asks, then what was the questioner thinking? If you can qualify the Braita the same way that you qualified the Mishnah, what was the questioner thinking? And he says, V'yesh lomar, Mishum d'hach Braita k'tani nezek v'tzar, Yehechi de nezek v'tzar ayri b'chol inyan, K'mon kein zacha b'dmei v'ladot ayri b'chol inyan. That the difference between our Mishnah, which is a singular topic, talking about dmei v'ladot, and over there, you could qualify it and say that it's only in the case where it happened during the lifetime of the ger. The Braita here is talking about numerous types or forms of payment, which seemingly do not have this limitation of being during the lifetime of the ger. And maybe the same should be true about the zacha that is found in the Braita. The Gemara says in the end that we reject that and that we qualify the Braita the same way that we qualified the Mishnah. V'baitema, lachar mitat ager. That we're talking about here, even after the mitat ager, betani zachta, not zacha, that the person who did the damage has the rights, but rather zachta, the wife is the one who gains the rights over here, or she gets the Dmei Vladot, which is the position of Rabba, that she is entitled to those Dmei Vladot. And it's also what it says over here, you're not emending the Braita to read the word Zachta, but rather the word Zachta in that context means whoever has rights will come and exert their rights. And the one with the biggest right over here is the woman herself, and therefore she will collect the Dmei Vladot in that situation. So Lema Ketanae, let's say this machlok between Rabban and Rav Chista is actually a machlok at Tanaim. Bat Yisrael, she needs to state the ger, and she's now pregnant. V'chaval ba b'chaya ger, and someone injured her while her husband was still alive, obtained Dmei Vladot, the ger. Then, in all, like we said in all these cases, the entitlement goes to the husband. L'char mitata ger, on the other hand, after the ger passed away, Tani chada chayav, we have one brayta that says you are chayav, and tani chada patur, and one brayta that says you are patur. My love, what can we assume here? Tanaei ninhu. This is a machloket tanaim, meaning that the argument that Rabba and Rav Chista are having is actually a machloket tanaim with regards to whether you're chayav or patur in the case of the mitat ager. So in the case where it's like Rabba, the Mita Dager would say you're still Chayav because the ownership transfers to the woman. On the other hand, Rav Chista, or the Breita that would support Rav Chista's position, is the one that says Patur, because once the husband dies, there's a complete relinquishment of the ownership of the Dmei Vladot, and it certainly does not go to the wife or to the woman. So that's what Gemara suggests, that maybe this is a Machloket Tanaim. Gemara says, the Rabba Vadai Tanaihi. According to Rabba, it's definitely a Machloket Tanaim. El Rav Chista Milema Tanaihi. Who says that it has to be a machloket tanaim over here? For Rabba, it has to be, because Rabba believes you are chayav over here. If Rabba believes you're chayav, how are you ever going to explain the braita that says you are patur? On the other hand, Rav Chista is the other way around. Rav Chista thinks that you are patur over here, and then I can figure out a reason why you're going to be chayav. And that's what the Gemara says over here. The Rabba vaday tanaihi, and the Rav Chista milema tanaihi, lo kasha. Harabono and harishim and gamliel. The difference between the chayav and the patur here is whether you hold like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, or you hold like the Chachamim, similar to what we saw in the second Braita, that Rabbi Shimon Gamliel believes that by the Shevach Vladot, the woman is entitled to 50% of the Shevach Vladot, where the Chachamim say that all the Shevach Vladot belongs to the husband. So therefore, the one who says Chayav over here is for the 50% that belongs to the woman. There you'd be Chayav because she owns that the Shevach of the Vladot, and you'd have to make compensation to her, and that's the bright that says Chayav. The bright that says Patur is like the Chachamim, who say that the entirety of the Shevach Vladot belongs to the husband. And since this injury or this miscarriage happened after the death of the husband, there's no one to take possession of it or to make a claim because he has no inheritors. And therefore, the Shevach Vladot are no different than the Dmei Vladot, which is that you have no one to make a claim, and then you won't be chayav for them, or the mazik, in a sense, takes possession of them immediately. If it's according to Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, what does it matter that the miscarriage took place after the death of the ger? Even while the ger is still alive, the wife is entitled to 50% of the value of the Shevach Vladot. So why is the case or the scenario that you're talking about in the Braita post the death of the husband? Gemara says, no, Michayim itla palgo lacharmita kule. While he is alive, she's only entitled to 50% of the Shevach Vladot. On the other hand, post the death of the husband, she's entitled to 100% of the Shevach Vladot. Because then she is zocha, not only in her 50% of the Shevach Vladot, but also in the 50% that belong to her husband. So when we're saying chayav over here, we're saying chayav for the 100% of the Shevach Vladot. And we're saying patur, we're saying according to the Chachamim that you're patur from the Shevach Vladot completely. The differences between what form of payment that you're speaking about. When you're talking about the Dmei Vladot, which belong to the ger, over there you are patur. When you're talking about the Shevach Vladot, which belonged to the wife, there you're going to have to make restitution. You're going to have to make payment because she's still around. So Amar says, Amri, Mishevach Vladot, Lishama Dmei Vladot. From the outcome by Shevach Vladot, where the woman owns 100% of the Shevach Vladot after the death of her husband, then we should then extrapolate from that to understand that by Dmei Vladot, she should also be the owner of the rites, and that would be like Rabbo and not like Rav Chista. If that's the position of Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, Lishamah the Rabbanan, we should extrapolate to the position of the Rabbanan. I says, Amrei lo, you can't do that. Shevach v'ladot d'shaycha yadabi gavayu. Shevach v'ladot, where she has rights to it prior to the death of her husband. She has a 50% right, according to Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, even while the husband is alive. Zachir behu bekulu. Therefore, she then gets 100% of the right after her husband passes away, because basically her ownership spreads to fill the void that is created by her husband. Dmei v'ladot lo shaycha yadabi gavayu. On the other hand, by Dmei v'ladot, while her husband is alive, she has zero interest in the Dmei v'ladot. Lo zachir behu kal. Therefore, after the death of her husband, she doesn't have any rights in them, because she never had any rights in them. And therefore, you can't extrapolate from the din of shevach v'ladot to Dmei v'ladot. And we can explain Dmei v'ladot l'Rav Chista, which is that the woman has no rights in them post the death of her husband, and they're completely unowned after the death of the husband, who has no yorshim, the case of the death of the ger. So here the Gemara says that your extrapolation is not a good extrapolation. Just because something's true by shevach v'ladot doesn't mean it'll be true by Dmei v'ladot. And the key reason is because of the nature of the woman's ownership. In shevach v'ladot, she does have ownership. That ownership allows her to then expand the ownership when her husband passes away and take control of all the shevach v'ladot. The other hand, by Dmei v'ladot, she has zero interest while her husband is alive. And for that reason, when he passes away, she won't gain any rights within the Dmei v'ladot. So now the Gemara says, "Vaymine Rav Yeva Sava Mirav Nachman, Makzik Bishtarutav Shel Ger Mahu." Someone who's holding on to documents of the ger, what is the din? Now, according to Rashi, these documents that he's holding over here are shibudim for loans. Basically, they are, it's outstanding credit that the ger is extended. People owe him money, but that is documented in the shtarot, that they owe money, or that he is entitled to land as collateral or in lieu of payment. That's the view of Rashi. On the other hand, the shtarotav here, according to the Rashba, are shtarot of Mecher or Memkar, or basically a shtar that evidences the sale of a land or a piece of property. So here's the nature of the Gemara's question, which is that you're holding this on behalf of the ger. The ger passes away. Ger passes away, everything is up for grabs. So that's what the nature of the question is. The person who holds the shtar is not for the contents of the shtar, but rather what the shtar is evidencing, which is the fact that he now owns this property. But with regards to the land, the person holding the shtarot never took possession of the land. Ushtara nami lo kano. And by a shtar also, you're not going to add the lav date ashtara. And he doesn't acquire the shtar as well, because he didn't have anything in mind with regards to the shtar. His whole focus was on the karka. The shtar was just evidence of that. So he didn't have any mind to be kone the shtar. So he doesn't have the land because he was never kona the land. He doesn't have the shtar because he was never kona the shtar. Because you can only be makzik in something when you're actually making a kinyan on it. Problem is here is that he doesn't have in mind to have kinyan on the shtar, because the shtar he just sees as a means, not as the end. The kinyan that he would have thought to me was a kinyan on the land or a kinyan on the extended credit, but not on the shtar itself, the physical paper of the shtar. And without that, he's not going to acquire the shtar over here. V'yata Yisrael Acher, v'chzikpa, l'tzura pitzlukito kanyo. If some other person comes along and grabs the piece of paper or the shtar to utilize as a cork, he would get to keep it. And if someone else comes and makes a key on the karka, he'll keep the karka. You know, this individual has nothing here. He doesn't get the karka because he didn't make a key on it. He doesn't get to keep the shtar because he didn't make a key on the shtar to utilize it for a cork. What he can't do is acquire the rights that are found inside the shtar. That he's unable to acquire. Those are intangible items which he doesn't have the ability to acquire. So because of that, he either has to make a kinyan on the land, which fails, or he has to make a kinyan on the shtar, not for its documentation purposes, but simply for it to utilize the paper upon which it was written. Since he had neither in mind, he doesn't get anything. And then someone who comes and makes a kinyan on the karka will get it. Someone who makes a kinyan on the shtar, they will get it. O Dilma, or maybe we would say, Date Nami Ashtara, that he has in mind not only for the land that underlies this contract or this credit note, but also the shtar itself. That when he makes a kinyan on the shtar, he's not only making a kinyan on the contents of the shtar, but he's also making a kinyan on the shtar itself, meaning the paper upon which it's written, he's also making a kinyan. Samalei, ani mori, v'chila tzura pitzluchito, tzarich, Please, my Rebbe, answer me. I don't understand what kinyan he's going to be making on this shtar. What exactly is he making a kinyan on this shtar for? To make it for a cork on top of his narrow earthenware utensils? That's what you're going to use it for? That's why he needs a kinyan? Rabbi Yevasava says back to Rabbi Nachman, Letzor, Menochanami. He'll utilize it for whatever he can. If it's no longer valid as a shtar, he'll use it as a cork. Say that even though he has in mind for the karka, or to make a kinyan on the karka, that's not his sole view, but he also has in mind to make a kinyan here on the shtar itself. Amar Rabba, Mashkano shel Yisrael biyad ger. If you have a mashkon that is in the hands of a ger, umeit a ger, and then the ger dies, ubayis el acher v'exikbo, and then a third party comes in to grab the collateral that was given by the Yisrael to the ger, motzino to miyado. We extract it from him, and we give it back to the original owner of the mashkon. My daima, kevin demitlei ger pokalei shibudei. Once the ger dies, his rights in this collateral, his shibud over here, disappears. In essence, or what we're saying here is he does not own the mashkon, he does not own the collateral. He simply owns a shibud, a right in the collateral. That right disappears with his death. And so that if that's the case, then the mashkon reverts back to the original owners, and they remain or retain their ownership inside of this object. This actually presents a difficulty in Rashi's position that we're talking about a shtar for shibud karkaot, because here the Gemara says that if there's a shibud, the shibud dissolves when the ger dies. If that's the case, even if he was to be koneh the karka in that case, it wouldn't be meaningful because there's only a shibud karkaot over here, there's no ownership of the karkaot. And for that reason, there are Rishonim who disagree with Rashi and say that we're talking about a shtar mecher here rather than a shtar halva'ah to avoid that problem. Of otherwise, what kinyan are you making over the karka? Now, even though we find in other contexts that when it comes to a mashkon, that the mashkon is considered to be the property of the individual who is holding the mashkon. See that in the Gemara Psachiah with regards to a guy who is holding on a chametz as collateral, but it's the Jew's chametz that he's holding. Over there, the Gemara says if he accepts responsibility for any damage that happens, achrayut on it, then it is fully in the possession of the goy, and it's not considered to be chametz shavar alava pesach. And therefore, after Pesach, if the Jew then has the money to repay the loan, he can take back the collateral that's chametz, because it's not chametz shavar alava pesach. So there you see that the collateral, the mashkon, is owned by the malveh and fully owned by the malveh. In addition, one in other places says from the din of Rabbi Yitzchak that the mashkon is the property or owned by the malveh. And that's because the Torah exhorts that the person who takes collateral from a person who is poor, that he should return that collateral each day for him to utilize it when he needs it, and then take it back at the end of the day when he no longer needs it. And there it says that Hashem will consider what you're doing a tzedakah. That will be a charitable, righteous thing that you are doing. Rabbi Yitzchak over there says if the malveh never owns the item, then what type of tzedakah is it that he's giving it back to the loveh? If it's the loveh's all along, then he's just returning what belongs to the loveh, and that can't be considered tzedakah. Tzedakah can only be if it was considered his, and then, after it was his, he returns it to the loveh. From both of those, you have proof, or seemingly a disagreement with our Gemara over here, that the mashkon really does belong to the one holding the collateral, and he has a full kinyan on it, unlike what we're suggesting over here, that there's only a shibud on the mashkon. Gozavot answers or tries to answer that question by suggesting that even in those scenarios where we believe that the mashkon is owned, quote-unquote, by the malveh, there's still an embedded option in there that the loveh can buy back the mashkon, which is that he doesn't have full and complete ownership over the mashkon because there is this buyback right from the loveh, which is that if he gets the money and he can repay the loan, he has a right to take the mashkon back against the will of the malveh. And so because of that, there really isn't true and complete ownership by the malveh over the object, but rather a shibud, which has been described over here by the ger. And that's why when the ger dies, the mashkon reverts back to the original owner of the mashkon. And the Maritz Chayit wants to go as far as to say that chametz might be unique in this area because chametz is involved as an isur hana'ah. And therefore, there is an automatic relinquishment of ownership here. You simply need some sort of pickup of the ownership by the other side. So the Torah takes away the ownership because of the Isur Hana'ah. As long as then the Goy picks up the Achrayut, he becomes the owner of the Chametz by default. But in other scenarios where there isn't any compelling Doraita reason that takes it out of the possession of the individual, then it remains in his possession, even if the Malvit accepts responsibility and is just a Shibud by the Malvit on the Mashkon, similar to the description that Tosavot is giving over here. Mashkono shel ger b'yad Yisrael. If the Mashkon of the ger is in the hands of Yisrael, umeta ger, and then the ger dies, uba Yisrael acher v'yachzik bo, and then a third party Yisrael comes and takes it, zekana keneged ma'utav, v'zekana etashar. In that case, the creditor gets his rights in the Mashkon, which are up to or capped out at the money that's owed to him by the ger. I mean, that his holding of the Mashkon here is to protect his getting paid for the loan. And that means the rights that he has in this Mashkon are up to the level of the loan. And that happens automatically with the death of the ger. He gets that right. The third party that comes in and takes the Mashkon at that point, he gets whatever in excess of the value of the loan. That belongs to him. Now, the Gemara says, Vamai, Tikne Le Chatziro. Why is it that this third party who comes in and takes possession has any rights here? Why doesn't the chatzer, the courtyard of the malveh, acquire on his behalf the entirety of the mashkon over here? Damar Rav Yosi bar Chanina, chatzer shel adam konelo shelo midato, that the courtyard of an individual can take possession of items on his behalf, even without his knowledge. Amrei ochi maskinan. What's the case here? Delete. He's not there. The malveh is not present. Koheicha deita ledide. Anywhere where he is, di bay makne matzikoni, that if he decided he wants to acquire it, he could acquire it. Kanyalei nami chatzero. Then his chatzer also acquires on his behalf. Kohecha deleite the day. In a case where he's not present, in that case, if he wants to make a kinyan, he can't make a kinyan because he's not present. Then chatzero nami lo kanyo. Then his chatzer itself also doesn't act on his behalf to do it. So his chatzer can only do whatever he can do. He can't be more powerful than he is. And so therefore, in the case that we're saying up here, that he's absent, in his absence, he can't make a kinyan. If he's absent, he can't make a kinyan. Neither can his chatzer make a kinyan on his behalf. Ve'uchato, and the loch is, deleite b'chatzero delo kana. That if the mashkon, this is the way Rashi reads it, if the mashkon is not as a chatzer, he's not kone it. So that's what Rashi does. Rashi splits the Gemara here and translates the word deleite differently. In the Havamina, or the first part of the Gemara, it says, the late day means that the malveh, the creditor, is not present. The late day here in the Hilchata is that the mashkon is not present. And what the Gemara says is that when the owner is not present, then there is no kinyan, because since he can't make a kinyan, his chatzir can't make a kinyan on his behalf. And vice versa, if he is present and he can't make the kinyan, then his chatzir can make a kinyan on his behalf. Separately, but it comes, derives from the same din, is Hilchata Deleite B'Chatzero. If the Mashkon is not present, Delo Kana, he's not Kone. The Chatzer can't be Kone, something that's not there, or the Mashkon that's not there. That's the way that Rashi reads it. You can see that in the Baal Tosafot, Perisha Kuntris, the Mashkon Kari, that this piece is going on the Mashkon. But then, what Tosafot says is you have to divide up the cases here as to the nature of the Chatzer. The Chatzer, a courtyard that is Hamishta Meret, that is a protected or guarded area where items that are in it are shielded from the public and maintain a certain amount of security or safety from being in there. In that case, the chatzer of an individual can acquire on his behalf, shalom idato, if he has no knowledge about it. On the other hand, if it's a chatzer she'ena mishtemeret, it's a chatzer that doesn't have that quality to it, it's a chatzer that's naturally open and exposed, in that case, the chatzir cannot acquire on his behalf, shalom idato. He can only acquire on his behalf when he's there, because his presence makes it into a chatzir mishtameret. Basically, he fills in the void. The fact that it's a chatzir that is not mishtameret, his presence then fills in that void. And so that's what you're saying over here, then Rashi, that you have two cases here. The first case is where delete, where he's not present. He's not present, and the chatzir is a chatzir she'ena mishtameret. His lack of being there, plus it being a chatzer and a mishtemeret, the chatzer can't acquire on behalf of the malveh. On the other hand, if it's a chatzer and a mishtemeret, but the baal is present, then his presence makes it into a chatzer mishtemeret, and it works. The second Hilchata, what Rashi says over here, is that it's a case where the Mashkon is not in the Chatzer. Well, what does it matter if the Mashkon's in the Chatzer or not? It all has to do with whether the Baal is present or not. What Baal Yitosvot says is, in this case, it's a Chatzer HaMishtameret. It's a Chatzer that is safe and protected, and therefore, if the item was in the Chatzer, you would have been Koneit. The problem is that the Mashkon is not in the Chatzer, and since it's not in the Chatzer, he's not Koneit. So that's the way Rashi reads it. Two different issues. And as the Baal Tosafot say, that they also require us to think about two different chatzerot as to the context of these two cases. On the other hand, the Baal Tosafot suggest that the delete over here is the same delete, which is that the Gemara says, oh, if the Baal's not there, it doesn't work. If the Baal is there, it does work. And then the Hilchata is, delete b'chatzerot, the lokana, that if the Baal is not present, then he's not koneh, meaning that we are accepting or acknowledging the statements that we made above and say that is the halacha in this manner. Now, Gemara continues here with the new Mishnah. The Mishnah says, a chufer bor b'shut yachid, u'petacho l'reshut rabim. He digs a cistern or a pit in his private domain, but he opens it up into the reshut rabim. Over reshut rabim, u'petacho l'reshut yachid. Or he did in the reshut rabim and opens it up into the reshut yachid. B'reshut yachid, u'petacho l'reshut yachid. I put it in, dug it out in Rishut Yachid, and opened it into Rishut Yachid Acher, Chayab. In all these cases, you are responsible for the boar that is there. Now, as far as the first case is very easy to understand. He dug the boar in the Rishut Yachid, but it opened up into the Rishut Rabim. So now you have a takala, or you have a problem in the shtayt of the Rishut Rabim, because that's where the opening is. And that's why he's going to be held responsible. On the other hand, if he digs under the Rishut Rabim and opens it up into the Rishut HaYachid, over there, why is he responsible for it? It opened up into the Rishut HaYachid. What's the issue? So Rashi claims over here that it's a case where Hifkir Rishuto. He then disowns his property, gives over his property to the public at large. And that's the problem, because now this boar exists inside of his property that he has now given over to the public. And that's what the problem is, that he has an obstacle in the middle of the public domain. Tosafot over here suggests that that does not have to be the scenario where he's actually mafkir the property, but it could be a case where the boar opens up in the Rishut Yachid adjacent to the Rishut Rabim, immediately adjacent to the Rishut Rabim, where he puts anybody that's walking through the Rishut Rabim at risk because they sometimes shift over a little bit or go a little bit outside of the Rishut Rabim, but his boar being there is a takala in that case. Now, the last case, which is the hardest of the cases, if it's a boar that was dug in the Rishut Yachid, uptacho the Rishut Yachid acher, he opened up into another Rishut Yachid, he's chayab. Rashi claims over here, he dug it in one of his pieces of property and then brought it up in another piece of his property, meaning that they both are in his own property. He dug down in one place and brought it up in another place. There he is, chayav, because again, Rashi suggests that he was mafkir the land. Since he's mafkir the land, there's a problem here because of the boar that exists now, or this takala that exists inside the Rishut Rabim. On the other hand, the Baal Tosafot suggests over here that that explanation doesn't make so much sense, because here it says, uptacho l'reshut yachid acher, to another Rishut Yachid, which implies not the same Rishut Yachid, but rather someone else's Rishut Yachid. So he dug the pit in his own field and then opened it up into someone else's field. And in that case, you could argue that's a case where the new owner was mafkirit, but the Baal Tosafot suggests that that is not the scenario here, but rather the scenario over here is that when he opens it up at the other Rishut HaYachid, he's responsible for the damage that happens in this new Rishut HaYachid. And the way that the Rishut explains the Chiddush over here is, V'itztrich, to teach you, the low time of Pitacho, the Rishut Rabim, who the Chayab, the Shechichi Rabim. And only when you open it up into the Rishut Rabim, where there's tons of people there, that's a Takala Omaski. When you open up into someone's private domain where there's limited numbers of people there, maybe only one person there, maybe that would not be considered to be a takala or a boar and you'd be pator. That's what the Mishnah comes to dispel that and tell you that you are chayav. Now, the Tosafot over here asks, based on the Gemara that we learned yesterday, which is that if your shore is taken into someone's yard or sedeh without permission, and then the shore digs up borot all over the sedeh, all over the field, we said yesterday that the Baal HaShor is chayav to pay for the damage to the field, and the Baal HaChatzer is chayav for the borot that are there because he should have filled them in, and he didn't fill them in. Why don't we say the same thing over here in our scenario? and that is the Perish Ari Kasha. In this explanation of the Ari, it's questionable. Lama hu chayav in escape bala chatzer im nafal shoro the boar. Why is the one who opened up the boar in the courtyard of his friend responsible for his animal falling in there? Kevin shechufer mishalem niske chatzer. Since the one who dug it out pays for the damage that's done, al bala chatzer lemluye becomes the responsibility of the bala chatzer now to fill in the borot. If he doesn't fill in the borot, he's going to be liable. Meaning the bala chatzer is going to be liable, not the one who dug the boar. So Tosfot says, if you say that, in the position of the Ri, I don't really understand why the bala boar is chayav over here. Boar, the one who dug the boar, is chayav. It should be the one who's bala chatzer, whose property it is, because he's the one responsible to fill it in. So either you have to say that it's a situation in which the bala chatzer has no idea that a boar came up in his property or was dug into his property, and that's why he is patur over here, or you have to suggest this would favor heavily the explanation we saw yesterday in the Raivad, that transition to the responsibility shifting from the bala shor to the bala chatzer, or in our case here, from the bala boar to the bala chatzer, only happens when you actually make payment. When you actually pay for the damage that's done, then there's that transference. The more bigger difficulties, according to those mefarshim that disagree, like Rashi, who says that immediately that transfer of ownership takes place. Tosafot says that the summary of our Mishnah is klalu de milta b'kol hach shmaitata bor batar pitcho azlina. The boar also always goes after where it opens up, and not where the actual body of the boar sits, but more importantly, where it opens up, whether it's into the Rishuti Yechid or the Rishuti Rabim, and so on and so forth. That is the key determinant of the status of the boar, and that's what's being borne out by our Mishnah. Tanu Rabbanan, a chofer boar b'Rishuti Yechid u'ptacho the Rishuti Rabim. Someone who dug a boar in the Rishuti Yechid and opened it up in the Rishuti Rabim, chayav, he is chayav. Zehu boar ha'mu'ur b'Torah, divi Rabbi Shmuel. Mishmael says this is the paradigmatic boar of the Torah. There's a case where you dig a boar in Rishut Yachid and you open it up into the Rishut Arabim. Because there you have private ownership, but the takala is in the Rishut Arabim where it can cause damage. Rabbi Kiva Omer, Hifkir Rishuto, Vlo Hifkir Boro, Zehu Bor Amur Batorah. The person relinquishes control or donates his property to the Rabim, but he maintains ownership of the boar that is inside of that property. That is Zehu Bor Amur Batorah. That is the classic case of the paradigmatic case of the boar in the Torah. All right, so we're going to stop here, five lines up from the bottom of Memtet Amud Bet.